This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the second week of September, and this week we finally had a one-stage Democratic presidential debate. But we did not really get the Biden versus Warren showdown that some people, including me, had been hoping for. Those two leading candidates did argue over health insurance, as has become traditional for the first 20 minutes of these debates, but they didn't really address their differing views on Wall Street. They also didn't discuss the 2005 bankruptcy reform bill that first brought Biden and Warren into opposition. Back then, he was a senator who said the law would make it easier and cheaper for people to borrow money, and she was an academic who said it would deprive struggling people of the opportunity to shed their debts and start fresh. The debate stage still felt awfully big to me. Part of the reason we didn't see enough of Biden and Warren was that he was busy arguing with Julian Castro, who at one point accused Biden of forgetting what he'd said minutes earlier about his health plan. After the debate, journalists rolled back the tape and found Biden actually hadn't contradicted himself. And while we were deprived of Marianne Williamson in this debate, the stage was still big enough for Andrew Yang to announce his campaign will give $12,000 away to each of 10 lucky winners as a sort of pilot program for the universal basic income at the core of Yang's campaign platform. So that happened. Now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. And on the left is Christine Emba of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having us.
And we also have a special guest today. Dorian Warren is president of Community Change, a progressive community organizing group. Hi, Dorian.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Christine, what did we learn in Thursday's debate?
So the main thing that I took away from the debate was that there's actually a huge number of energetic, substantive candidates on the Democratic side just waiting to get into the election. Joe Biden doesn't necessarily need to be the front runner. If he wasn't there, the field would still be just as strong. Also, the Democratic candidates seemed very pleasantly and encouragingly united against Trump, for one, and also against discussing the actual issues that people care about. Instead of, you know, fighting and falling all over themselves as they seem to have done in 2016, it seems like most of the candidates actually like and respect each other and would be happy to support the nominee in the end.
It's funny, Dorian, this was a little bit of a point of contention at the debate. You had a couple of candidates, I believe it was Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, basically saying, you know, stop fighting with each other so much. And Julian Castro was like, this is a debate. That's what we do in a primary debate. But it sort of seemed like he was the only one out there with the really combative style that didn't seem like people were going to be able to smile and make up once there's a nominee.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Castro, with the former Secretary Castro. It is a debate, and we have short memories in politics because there was a fierce debate in 2008 that also involved, you know, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton. They weren't playing nice. We've always had fierce debates in the Democratic Party and, frankly, in the Republican Party, too. That is what a primary is for. And remember, Senator Harris was very, very sharp and crisp in the very first debate, right? And so we've kind of forgotten that already, too. So, yes, I think even if I thought his punch fell flat against Biden, that's Secretary Castro's punch, I agree. This is a debate. They should have it out. This is the time and moment. Unity is later.
Rich, what did you learn?
Well, I don't have any on this issue. I don't have any problem with fierce debate and actually saying, oh, you know, we're all being too nasty, we should unite, is a way to win a debate. It's a way not to not have a debate. Yeah. It's a way to position yourself vis-a-vis the others. But the problem with the Castro jab against Biden was, one, that he got the substance wrong. Biden hadn't actually said what Castro said he had and had forgotten, and also just seemed too mean-spirited. But it gets to a real concern. I don't think it's a concern that there's any percentage in the other candidates bringing up, and voters just have to decide themselves, is Biden up for this? And we got a bifurcated picture last night. I thought he was really strong at the beginning. I think he won the healthcare exchange. I think he's clearly more energetic and aggressive in a good way, willing to take on Warren and Sanders and their plans in a way that others who disagree with them, Klobuchar and Buttigieg, have traditionally not. They're a little more front-leaning on that last night. But then towards the end, except for the very last answer, whenever he goes personal about, you know, his terrible tragedies he's faced in his family, he's just is exceptionally good. But before that, there are two answers, the record player answer that's gone a little viral, that just made you kind of wonder, you know, when he gets a little tired, has he really lost a step? And you'd worry about that during the course of a real rigorous campaign against an opponent who will use every means, fair and very often foul, to take advantage of any slips.
You know, funny, Christina, it's funny you say Biden doesn't have to be the front runner, but he is the front runner. And I think, you know, what Rich describes there, I think Biden's performance was uneven. I think it was weaker toward the end of the debate than at the beginning. But I also think this was the best performance he turned in of the three debates he's been in. And the previous two debates, you know, have you know, even though there was a bit of a stumble in the polls after the first debate, he has not surrendered his lead after any of those. So it suggests to me that whatever performance he's turning in is connecting better with Democratic primary voters than it's connecting with people in the commentariat.
So a few thoughts on that. I would actually agree with you that this was definitely by far Joe Biden's best debate, but it wasn't actually a good performance. It was just better than the last two, which is not exactly what you want to see. Like, oh, it wasn't terrible this time. Congratulations. I think the Democrats need more than that. But actually, and I was thinking of saving this for the tweet segment, but Jamel Hill, who writes for The Atlantic, actually had the tweet that I thought best summed this up. And she wrote, "Somebody's got to say it. The overwhelming support for Joe Biden is based purely off fear that white people won't vote for anyone else on the stage, because there's no way you see him in these moments and think that he's actually the best candidate." And I think that's totally true. Everyone is, you know, pulling their weight, throwing their weight behind Joe Biden because he seems electable. He seems like someone you could vote for. He seems this, he seems that. But he's actually not that good these days, and it's becoming obvious.
And let me just add to Christine's point again on the long memory. We were in the same place in 2008. Barack Obama was not leading in the polls at this time in 2007, right? Like, it wasn't until Iowa that especially black voters who didn't think he could win and were supporting Hillary Clinton, who was the front runner, switched their votes by South Carolina. So I think it's actually way too early, and we'd be remiss not to remember our own history of how this primary has gone in several cycles before.
Yeah, but here's how I'd push back on that, is who's going to overtake Biden with black voters in the way that Obama did with Hillary in 2008. You know, I mean, when you look at who black voters who aren't for Biden are supporting, you tend to see, you know, relatively strong support for Kamala Harris, sometimes for Cory Booker compared to white voters. You do not see Elizabeth Warren making serious ground with black voters, nor do you see Bernie Sanders improving his standing with black voters compared to what he did 4 years ago when he overwhelmingly lost black voters to Hillary Clinton. So if you had Elizabeth Warren coming out of Iowa or Bernie Sanders coming out of New Hampshire, I don't imagine that there's a groundswell of black voters in South Carolina who are just waiting for the signal that Elizabeth Warren can win a general election and they should switch over to her. And while I think a few months ago you could imagine the scenario where Kamala Harris has a breakout and she's able to claim the black vote in South Carolina, I don't see what her path is in Iowa or New Hampshire. I think that, you know, Barack Obama managed to win as a so-called wine track candidate because he put together this coalition of progressive whites. Although I think people talk about progressive whites, that section of the Democratic Party that people are talking about when they say that is less white than it used to be, although it is still majority white. But anyway, he combined that group with black voters. And I don't see Elizabeth Warren, who I think is this cycle's wine track candidate, being able to build that coalition. And I don't see Bernie being able to build a coalition of more downscale white voters with black voters. So I think, you know, that happened in 2008. I just don't see how you repeat that this time.
I think that's all based on what you see in the polls. And that's the same mistake we made in 2007, 2008. The polls can tell you a snapshot in time. It depends on the ground game won. Who has the best ground game, and are we really tracking what's happening in Iowa? Are we tracking what's happening in South Carolina? And by the way, there's a second big factor here, and that's California on Super Tuesday. That's a game changer. And I don't see California voters who are much further to the left of the Democratic primary going for Biden. So I think actually it's going to end up more scrambled than we might predict today just looking at polls, much like folks in 2007 in this moment thinking Hillary was going to run away with it.
Christine?
And I just want to jump in, yeah, really quickly and point out that I am a black voter, actually. And while I can't speak for black voters as a bloc, or really speak for anyone's opinions except for my own and what I have, you know, seen and heard talking to people, including relatives and friends, I think that black voters just want to win against Trump. And I think that they are willing to, you know, support a candidate that comes forward who seems like they can do that. Right now, Joe Biden seems perhaps like the most obvious person you could put up against Trump. You know, like an older white man, he attracts those mysterious Trump voters that we're always talking about, even though it's not clear that they're so major as a part of the electorate. But I think that black voters care about the issues, They care about electing somebody who will be a good leader and who they can trust to stand up for the things that they care about. And they care about electing a winner. And while that might look like Joe Biden in the moment, if it turns out that that isn't Joe Biden, they could vote for someone else.
I don't know. I feel like, I mean, you talk about making the mistakes reading the polls in 2008. I feel like people are making the mistakes that they made in 2016 in the Republican primary, where you had a candidate who really had much less support among both the commentariat and organizational elites within the party than among the voter base. And sort of an assumption that, oh, you know, this lead in the polls, that's got to be an error. That's got to be, you know, once people really pay attention, they're going to change their mind. And I just don't see evidence of that. I don't think it's that early anymore. You know, we're going to be voting in Iowa in what is a little over 4 months now. The level of attention that people pay to politics has gone up so much in the Trump era that I also think early isn't as early as it used to be. So I think, you know, at some point, if there's going to be that shift, really when people focus in on whoever it is, whether it's Warren or somebody else, you're going to see that poll shift. And I realize that she's been going up in the polls, but he hasn't really been going down. He's been basically flat. It's Bernie and Kamala who have been going down. So I think, you know, at some point, if you're going to overtake Biden, you have to actually overtake Biden.
Yeah, so I'm not predicting an inevitable Biden collapse here, but one thing I think is different from the Trump phenomenon, and it wasn't evident to a lot of us who were opposing him in the primaries, was people really bonded to him and, you know, felt impassioned by him. And I don't see that so much with Biden. A huge element of it, not in its entirety, but a big element is electability, which is a circular argument. So if he slips a little in the polls, if he loses Iowa, that could look different. And I just, if I were a Democrat, and I'm emphatically not, just last night, I would be very open to looking beyond the top three, because I think there's a performance issue with Biden. It's not disqualifying, but you have to be worried about. I think, you know, electing a self-declared socialist is really hard. I think electing Elizabeth Warren with some of these positions she's now taken is very hard. So I'd look elsewhere. And in terms of the African-American candidates, one of my hot takes, though, from last night, I think Booker is stronger than Harris. I think Harris can't own who she really is. She's a tough, no-nonsense prosecutor and fighter. And just the cheerful thing she was doing last night felt so painfully synthetic. And I think Booker's been – he's been good in all the debates. It's just a question – you could say this also of Buttigieg, a little of Klobuchar too. She hasn't been quite a strong performer. But it never seems to add up to anything. But if I had to bet on it, eventually of any of them breaking out a little bit, it would be Booker.
Well, let's talk about some of those issue discussions and disagreements that they had during the campaign, because obviously, as Rich notes, that's going to be important, not just for who wins the nomination, but what sort of general election campaign they can run. I want to start briefly with healthcare, which is where the debate started. Even though all the debates have started with healthcare, I thought this discussion was very similar to the ones that we've heard previously. But I did want to highlight an exchange with Elizabeth Warren that I think has frustrated her, because I think she's had this exchange over and over.
Direct question. You said middle-class families are going to pay less, but will middle-class taxes go up to pay for the program? I know you believe that the deductibles and the premiums will go down. Will middle-class taxes go up? Will private insurance be eliminated?
Look, what families have to deal with is cost, total cost. That's what they have to deal with. And understand, families are paying for their health care today. Families pay every time an insurance company says, sorry, you can't see that specialist. Every time an insurance company says, sorry, that doctor is out of network. Sorry, we are not covering that prescription.
So, Dorian, this is a question she keeps getting asked because she keeps not answering it. And, you know, I certainly get the argument that, you know, you have to look at taxes in combination with other things to figure out who's going to be better off. But people find, will my taxes go up, to be a relevant question. And I think this conversation sort of starts from an assumption that you're talking to voters who are ideologically left, who are partisan Democrats, and therefore they're inclined to trust a candidate who says, trust me, you're going to come out ahead in this trade no matter what happens to your taxes. I don't think that's realistic about how you have to make that pitch when you're actually trying to get it through Congress and convince people, no, really, you're going to be better off. At some point, you're going to have to talk with them about what their tax bill is going to be.
Yeah, two things on this. I think this is one of, for her strength, I think this is one of Senator Warren's vulnerabilities, because she presents herself as two things, right? So being the, she has a plan for everything and is crisp and sharp and smart and wonky, right? On everything else. And she wraps it in a personal story. So she's really good at that on almost everything. This is something where she should not be stumbling. She should be very clear. You either agree with Bernie or you don't, or you're going to move to the center like Klobuchar and the others and make the rationale, make the pitch for the reason why. The other thing I think, though, around healthcare as an issue, and I heard the head of the DNC Tom Perez saying this in the spin room after. It's like healthcare is the number one issue for Democrats, and this is the typical problem of the Democratic Party, and this is actually why Trump won in 2016. The assumption that it's issues, one or two issues that motivate voters, as opposed to an emotional connection to a deep story that gets people out. And so I worry about getting into the trap, at least on the Democratic side, about, well, she doesn't get the healthcare thing right, she's going to lose, as opposed to, like, what is the underlying story that resonates with voters that will motivate them around a range of issues? But I think this is one of her vulnerabilities.
Christine, what do you make of that?
I actually think that that is true, although I think about it in slightly different terms and just what voters are looking for and what they want to hear. Yes, they do have, you know, specific issues that concern them. But yes, those issues are situated in sort of a larger understanding of what their lives look like now and what they could look like in the future, depending on who the presidential candidate is. The president is when they are elected. And I was also, you know, a little bit disappointed by that Warren answer, because I think that I believe that voters can and in fact want to, you know, hear the real answer here. And I think that they can handle it because it makes sense. You know, if Elizabeth Warren actually, you know, came out and admitted, and she did, you know, make this a little bit clearer later on, that yes, in fact, your taxes may go up, but your healthcare costs will go down, and that means you'll still have a net gain. That's not that hard to understand. I think that's a pretty compelling proposal, and people can get behind that. Like, oh, your taxes might go up by a few $100s, but then you won't be accidentally slapped with a $5,000 healthcare payment because your insurance didn't cover it. That's the trade-off we're asking for. Okay, cool. Voters could get it.
Yeah, that's what she was saying by implication, but she just didn't want to come out and say it because she knows it's politically treacherous, whereas Bernie will just say it. So I don't know whether you guys are right and this is a weakness or whether this is a strength, because her play is kind of Bernie on substance but being more acceptable to the practical-minded Democrat and to the Democratic establishment. So it's a bit of a straddle, and we saw it in that answer.
I also thought the trade conversation that they had was a little bit surprising, in that the question was, you know, would you repeal President Trump's China tariffs on day one? And the candidates were very reluctant to take that position. They were also mostly reluctant to lay out really a robust approach to either trade or China at all. I thought Biden was an exception to this, where Biden basically said without saying the words Trans-Pacific Partnership that he would try to reconstitute the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement to bring together the U.S. with other non-China countries around the Pacific to try to set the terms on trade policy so China doesn't. But otherwise, I thought it was interesting how vague they were, but I was also interested that Harris came out and explicitly said, I am not a protectionist Democrat. You have a Democratic Party where the polling suggests Democratic voters are more inclined toward free trade than ever. That's probably in large part a reaction to Trump. The Democratic voters are against whatever President Trump is for, and President Trump is for protectionism. But I feel like that's an opportunity for Biden and Harris to actually get closer to where the soul of the Democratic Party is right now, whereas on a lot of other issues, you probably have Warren and Sanders where the real energy is.
Here's the problem of the Democratic Party. President Trump is still in the left's position on trade, point blank, and they're scrambling. And it's hard for me to say, but it's the truth, right? And the only two plays they have are to attack the president on competency in executing his hard line on China, or to pander to Iowa voters. That's all they got. And instead, no one has offered a robust alternative that some parts of the left would say needs to be part of any future trade negotiations or trade deals. Workers and environmentalists have to be at the table. It can't just be big companies, IP lawyers, intellectual property lawyers that are driving the conversation. This is a huge problem, I think, for the Democratic Party, because they haven't recovered from the president stealing the thunder of the left on this.
The problem with talking about labor and environmental standards is that everyone is in favor of some sort of labor and environmental standards, and you can't really get into the key question is what you're going to do in the negotiation when people say no to things that you're asking for. Because Elizabeth Warren, I think rather like Donald Trump, has laid out a list of asks from our trading partners that she's not going to get. And so the question is she going to then, you know, follow Trump's lead and try to blow up the global trading system? Or is she going to cave on a lot of those requests and maybe make some incremental changes? And then maybe her policy isn't that different from Joe Biden's policy. I think it's impossible to really get into that in detail in a debate.
It mobilizes two key Democratic base voters.
Right.
It mobilizes labor. It mobilizes people that care about the environment.
Rich, some of the candidates, Biden and Harris, were saying things that you might, you know, hope to hear from a Republican candidate for president who isn't Trump.
Yeah, but essentially that's sentiment's not getting wider expression given the swing in Democratic sentiment, as you note, in a pro-trade direction. I just wonder how real that Democratic sentiment is, and if it's kind of an inch deep because it's a reaction to Trump. But what you get from a lot of them, this was basically Buttigieg's answer as well, is, well, yeah, we just cut a better deal, which ends up being like what Trump was saying, you know, before he got in this himself.
It's really difficult to talk about trade in a debate because it's a complicated topic and you don't really know what deals you have to strike until you have a deal in front of you that you have to say yes or no to. So I do think that actually Democrats are being pretty smart by going with the competence play. Like, it's obvious that our trade policy right now is incompetent. And if a candidate can just, you know, lay out their overarching goals and sort of the spirit and the ideals that they will take into future trade debates, I do think that voters can get a sense of where they stand and align themselves with that. But getting into the minutiae of TPP on the debate stage is not really going to help the voters understand, and it's certainly not going to make the candidates more interesting.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review, Christine Embo of The Washington Post, and Dorian Warren of Community Change to talk about gun control. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. And our special guest is Dorian Warren, president of Community Change. I thought the gun control conversation at Thursday's debate was remarkable. First of all, we saw how far left much of the party has moved on the gun issue. Here's Beto O'Rourke seeking to differentiate himself by calling for confiscation of certain kinds of semi-automatic rifles.
You said, quote, Americans who own AR-15s and AK-47s will have to sell them to the government, all of them. You know, the critics call this confiscation. Are you proposing taking away their guns, and how would this work?
I am. If it's a weapon that was designed to kill people on a battlefield, if the high impact, high velocity round, when it hits your body, shreds everything inside of your body because it was designed to do that so that you would bleed to death on a battlefield and not be able to get up and kill one of our soldiers. When we see that being used against children, and in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. Mm-hmm. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be...
Christine, this is a long way from Hillary Clinton saying that she's not here to take away your guns.
Oh, yeah. This was, I think, one of the most interesting and exciting and perhaps a little scary for some voters moments of the debate. But I actually thought that it was, you know, really helpful, fascinating, and energizing to actually see someone make a strong and clear statement on gun control. Instead of trying to pander or sort of wiggle around and not frighten anyone, just say what you're going to do.
Well, and that's, you know, Rich, this is something that I think Republicans were interested to hear as well, because I think they've been suggesting for a long time that Democrats do want to take away your guns, and here's one saying, yes, I want to do that.
Yeah, so I think the effect of this will really be to further undercut, not that any conservatives were on board with it to begin with, but the more minimalist, realistic gun control agenda, because, you know, the case has been, well, they just say they want to do licensing, but that's because they want to know who has the guns so they can come take them. Like, no, you're crazy, you're paranoid. They say they want to do universal background checks and you need a registry, and they want a registry because they want to come get your guns. No, you're crazy. And here you have a Democratic presidential candidate just saying, yeah, that's what we're going to do, and getting applause for it. So I think it undercuts that agenda. And it's also Beto burning his boats. I mean, he's not winning anything in Texas except for maybe it's mayor of Austin. And I think he gets a bump from this. He probably gets more fundraising. But I also think he's never, not that he had much chance of this to begin with, ever is going to be elected president of the United States. So I don't know what the point of it is.
I think Beto knows that. He's not going to win the nomination. I think he is aware of that fact, but he actually has found a topic that he feels very passionate about, and for good reason. And actually, I know that we talk about polling and scaring off Republicans, But the majority of American voters are in favor of gun control. 57% in, I think, the latest Marist poll are in favor of at least banning sales of semi-automatic weapons. Like, most Americans actually would like to see something done.
But so, Dorian, most Americans want to see something done, depending on how you phrase the questions about gun control. But this is a policy proposal that you wouldn't get through the U.S. Congress. You didn't even have full support for this on the debate stage. Amy Klobuchar, a member of the U.S. Senate, was saying that she only wants a voluntary buyback program. So I feel like we're seeing something that we see on a number of issues, including healthcare, where you have Democrats getting out on a limb, adopting policy positions that may be unpopular with the broader general electorate. For what end? Because they're endorsing proposals that even if they win the election, even if Democrats win a majority in both houses of Congress, they still won't be able to enact it. And to Rich's point, it could also undermine political support for more moderate gun control measures that really do have broad support among the public and could get majority support in Congress.
Josh, I'm going to play your role for a minute because I actually agree and disagree with both Rich and Christine on this one. So I'm kind of in the middle. I think it was the best moment for Beto in terms of the emotional resonance and passion he expressed on this issue. It was one of his finest moments in the debate. And clearly, this is the strategy for the campaign going forward, but through an unfortunate event, obviously. The problem, however, is this is exactly what Rich said. It feeds the flames of what the NRA and the right have been saying about the left for decades, and particularly what President Trump said. Democrats really, when they come out the closet on this, want to confiscate and take away your guns and threaten your Second Amendment rights. And that seems to be that could mobilize the opposition. And it's different than healthcare because there is an intensity of preference on this issue for the right in a way that I think is much higher than, say, healthcare for Democratic voters. And so I actually do wonder if it's a strategic mistake in a Democratic primary to really go hard on, yeah, we're going to confiscate them. On the other hand, as you pointed out, whoever wins the nominee, and it won't be O'Rourke, can basically stake out the middle position and explicitly contrast themselves and say, well, that's like the far left. That's not what I'm for. I'm actually for common sense, reasonable gun safety.
There was a nod also in this conversation to the difficulty of getting things through Congress. And we had this exchange about Kamala Harris's proposal to use an executive order to try to impose new gun control measures.
In recent days, former Vice President Biden has said about executive orders, some really talented people are seeking the nomination. They said, I'm going to issue an executive order, Biden saying there's no constitutional authority to issue that executive order when they say I'm going to eliminate assault weapons, saying you can't do it by executive order any more than Trump can do things when he says he can do it by executive order. Does the Vice President have a point there?
Some things you can, many things you can't.
Let's let the senator answer.
Oh, I mean, I would just say, hey, Joe. Instead of saying, no, we can't, let's say, yes, we can.
Let's be constitutional. We got a constitution.
And yes, we can.
What kind of answer is that? I mean, and this is a theme that you've seen throughout these debates, that Biden and other moderate candidates are attacked for being downers, and maybe sometimes they are understating the possibility of getting certain policies through. But sometimes they're right, either that things are politically impossible or that things are legally impossible. Not everything that you want to promise to your base, you can give them. What is the usefulness of basically saying, you know, yes, I can do this by executive order, and if you say otherwise, just stop being such a downer?
You want to go?
Terrible answer. It was one of her worst moments. And, you know, here to Joe Biden, at least being interested in what constitutional authority exists for such an order. But a sweep, it'd just be imposing sweeping gun control legislation by executive fiat. And there's no support for that in our laws or constitution.
Although this should be a bipartisan issue. I think there's a deeper structural issue that goes back several presidential administrations. There has been an expansion of presidential power and authority aided and abetted by the Supreme Court. Happened in Bush, it happened under Obama, it has happened under Trump. And so for both parties to not draw a line on constitutional power of the executive office is a serious problem, and I think almost a crisis in this country. And I actually see some bipartisan – I don't know who I am today. I see some bipartisan like room here to like draw that back a little bit. And, you know, I think Biden was right in his answer, but he wasn't doing that in practice. He and the president and President Obama were expanding executive authority all the time. So this is a deeper structural problem, I think, in American politics we have to grapple with.
I think there's two separate but related issues here. One is the creep of executive power, and, you know, Barack Obama saying that he can't just change immigration policy through executive order and then going and doing it and that sort of thing. But then there's also stuff that you actually can't do through executive power, and if you try as president, the courts will stop you. And I think under President Trump, often it's not, the president is not a dictator. They, you know, even though they have succeeded in greatly expanding their power, the expansion has not been endless. And you've seen a lot of these executive orders under Trump that I think are basically performative, that he's trying to look like he's using executive power even when it's going to fail in the courts. And I think Harris was essentially proposing to do that here. You know, we'll issue an executive order because it feels good, even though it's not actually going to be part of the real creep in executive authority that you describe. And Christine, what this points to for me is I feel like each in their own way, Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden are the two candidates who really project that they're thinking seriously about being president and how they will marshal power if they are president. And a lot of the other candidates on the stage, I feel like, are more just talking about what would feel good because they're not front runners and they haven't really had to grapple with, you know, how am I actually going to do anything if I get there?
Yeah, I would agree with that, actually. And I think that's because both are much closer to either having been a vice president or much closer to, you know, the presidential decision making. Bernie Sanders is, you know, sort of a front runner, but he is just doing his Bernie Sanders thing and like no one really knows what that is. I think that they have, I think, perhaps more experience and have actually thought more deeply about the role and what the role entails. And that, I think, is also one reason why voters might find those two candidates a bit more reassuring even than some of the, you know, fresh young faces who are on deck during these debates. Like, yes, everyone has really great ideas, but who can put them into practice? And that's something that some of the older and more experienced candidates do have going for them.
I want to talk about two candidates who have been prosecutors and questions that they faced about their records as prosecutors. Rich alluded to this earlier about Kamala Harris and how she talks about this. There were questions to her and also to Amy Klobuchar, who was the prosecutor in Minneapolis before she was in the Senate. And basically, you know, how did your records as a prosecutor square with what you say about criminal justice reform now? Did you make choices that were overly punitive? That sort of thing. What did we make of these answers, Dorian? I mean, in particular, Klobuchar focused on, you know, well, look, I really focused on trying to clear unsolved murders in minority communities, and that was really important, sort of focusing on that, you know, there's not just over-policing, there are also under-policing problems and how she tried to deal with that.
Look, I'm all about the critique of both Klobuchar and Harris by criminal justice activists and organizers, but people aren't stuck in time. So we should raise the critique, but let's realize the left and through, frankly, movement energy has shifted this conversation around criminal justice reform, and the public actually now agrees that we have become way too punitive and it's too costly. And so, frankly, the fact that both of them have to defend their records is good. They have also moved left. That's how democracy works, people. You change your positions based on public pressure. So I'm like a little frustrated by the purist kind of connotations of this from some parts of the left, frankly. This is where we want people to move. This is the role of a primary. You move candidates either to the right in the Republican Party or to the left in the Democratic Party on these issues. Have they evolved on their answers? Yes. And I support that. Who has not really evolved or caught up, I would actually argue, is Joe Biden for all the critiques he's taken around his criminal justice platform from the 90s.
I would agree with that. I think that one of the important things, though, for these debates and for how candidates talk about this question moving forward is how they signal and make clear how they've evolved and why. And I think we saw, you know, two different modes of doing that in this debate from Harris and Klobuchar. And one was OK. She's working on it. And Klobuchar's was, frankly, bizarre. And it didn't work. Her response was, that's not my record. We're at an HBCU. OK. I think that's what I'm going to answer whenever someone asks me a question that I don't want to answer. I don't know who did it. We're at an HBCU. That is not an answer to anything, in fact, that doesn't show how she's evolved. It just shows that she's avoidant, and it's not a good look.
Rich, you were talking about this earlier, and basically that this has just become something that totally hampers these candidates. I actually think these are the strongest answers that Kamala Harris gives. It's clear that this is an issue that she's thought about, and that when she and that she cares deeply about, and then when she's changed her mind, she has an account of why she changed her mind. It's very different from healthcare, where it sort of feels like, you know, this administration's probably not going to do a lot on healthcare, so you need a plan you can wave around and change it to be whatever's convenient. It really, she really gives the image of a candidate who has thought deeply about this, because she has.
Yeah, so in my earlier point, just to be clear, I wasn't talking about her record per se. I was talking about her persona. I think that's she's a prosecutor. That's what she is. And she'd be better served just embracing that for better or worse and seeing how it goes, rather than, I think, sort of this false cheeriness we saw the other night. But this is my – I think Dorian's point is correct. You want to convert people – by definition, you have people change their minds. And the standard should be, have you given us an honest account of why you changed your mind? Walk us through it. Apologize for, you know, being wrong if you now think that is the case. And I'm not sure we saw that last night. You can make the case that she's done it prior to that.
Can we talk about Andrew Yang? I think I said on this show about 6 weeks ago that we were talking about Andrew Yang for the last time. And so, unfortunately, that was incorrect. Andrew Yang announced before this debate that he was going to do something that nobody's ever done on a presidential debate stage before. And then we learned that what that is that there's going to be basically a sweepstakes, that the Yang campaign is going to pay $1,000 a month for a year to 10 lucky winners, and that this is basically supposed to be a pilot or a marketing campaign for his universal basic income proposal that is the centerpiece of his policy proposal, that every American should receive a so-called freedom dividend of $1,000 a month. Dorian, how do you feel about what Andrew Yang is doing to raise the profile of this issue of universal basic income, making himself the face of it?
How'd you know I have all the feelings about this? So, look, I'm engaged in this conversation around UBI and guaranteed income, and it is starting to be a serious conversation in America linked to some big issues. The future of work in the economy, artificial intelligence, robots, just the problem of potential problem of joblessness in the future, the problem of joblessness and low work now, right? So there is a serious conversation happening around guaranteed income. There are actually existing pilots, one in Stockton, California, led by Mayor Tubbs in that city, that is ongoing, another in Mississippi. So this is actually happening, and it's serious. Yang, what he did last night was a desperate campaign ploy to distract from a serious discussion around a structural problem facing Americans. And it, you know, he continues to be a one-note person, candidate. And, it, you know, by the end of the debate, anybody remember this? You know, it wasn't even the conversation. By the end of the debate, I just find it to be a little over the line and not really engaged in a serious discussion.
Well, I think it goes to an interesting thing about Andrew Yang's support, which is that even though he's running in the Democratic primary, he has a lot of supporters who would identify as libertarians. And there's sort of two schools of thought if you're going to be in favor of a universal basic income. Is a universal basic income a layer on top of an existing welfare state that means a really substantial expansion of the size of government, of taxes and spending? Or is the intention to replace a significant amount of what the government does right now? And that's the way Yang talks about it, basically. Trust people to fix their problems for themselves by giving them money instead of giving them programs and services. And Christine, I think that, you know, he is gotten himself a small but devoted following with that idea. Obviously, he got above 2% in enough polls to qualify for this debate. But it seems like the sort of thing that you could take outside the Democratic Party. It's almost something that should maybe worry some of these candidates a little bit, that even though Yang's not going to get a lot of supporters, they're ones that conceivably could be taken away in a general election in a way that, say, you know, Julian Castro's supporters could not.
You know, I do think that's true. I think that libertarians and tech bros and Silicon Valley dudes gravitate towards Andrew Yang, but they were always going to gravitate towards a candidate like that. And I don't think that that's the population that the majority of Democratic candidates should be worried about. Honestly, I would have to give a hard agree to Dorian here, because I am tired of Andrew Yang. You know, I was hoping that his big surprise would just be that he like wore a hoodie on the stage like a real tech bro. But this This announcement was ridiculous, frankly. It trivialized the question of UBI, those who contributed to his campaign, and even the way that he announced it in his introduction fell incredibly flat. You know, Amy Klobuchar had just finished saying, Donald Trump is running America like a game show, and then Angry Yang says, and 10 lucky Americans are going to win $1,000. It's like, okay, come on. Like, we don't need this. Nobody asked for this. Literally zero people.
The remarkable thing about this, though, is, I mean, you have to go to his website to sign up to be eligible to win.
It's like a scam.
Well, it's a list-building exercise. Right. He's going to get all these emails. All these people who are Democratic primary voters who didn't give a lot of thought to Andrew Yang will be drawn to go to his website for the first time, and then Yang will be able to email them over and over about his campaign and his positions on the issues. So, I mean, you compare it to other things campaigns do to list-build, it's probably actually pretty financially efficient, $120,000. I mean, how many gross ratings points in Iowa does that buy you?
Yeah.
Maybe that's, you know, maybe it is a smart campaign strategy, even though it is undignified and ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a gimmick that will work. It's a gimmick that will work at that level. But I agree with my colleagues. A lot of people are charmed by Yang and find him interesting and think we need to hear more. I'm not charmed. I don't find him that interesting. I think he's desperately wrong. I just think if it's true that labor-saving technological innovation just permanently blew people out of the labor market, this economy would have had no one working, you know, 100 years ago when we have major agricultural innovations. There are always new demand. There's always new wants. And actually, we're not suffering from over automation. We're suffering from the opposite. Productivity is low, in part because automation hasn't been having the effect that we want it to. And if this is a huge problem, giving people $1,000 a month will not come even close to solving it. It's the cataclysm that he posits.
Like I was saying, there is a serious discussion and debate, right? And the economists are having it, like, what will the future economy be? Like, you can go on three different scenarios. Will it be the same? Will it be radically different? Or will it be somewhere in between? And we can have that debate. This does not seem like smart campaign strategy to me. Because at the end of the day, when his campaign is over, what does he do? And where do his followers go? And how does he want to leverage the hundreds of thousands of donors he actually has and the millions of people following him? How is he going to persuade and tell a story that convinces the party that this is a good idea? What he did last night doesn't serve that purpose. It doesn't get to a platform, right, of UBI on the right at the convention. It just doesn't. So what? It's not a smart strategy. It is a gimmick, and it actually makes fun of the idea that it deserves serious conversation.
Dorian Warren is president of Community Change. Dorian, thank you so much for joining us to break
down the
debate.
Thanks, great to be with y'all.
Still with me are, on the left, Christine Emba of The Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. Before we take a break, as many of you know, it's fundraising season for KCRW, and we're taking only 30 seconds here and there to ask you to support us and the other shows you love. And we're sweetening the deal this year with a left, right, and center hat. It says Civilized Yet Provocative right on the front, and it is super cool, very fashionable. I want to thank some left, right, and center listeners really quick who have already donated. Kathleen Klompien and Joel Wedberg said they, quote, donated during Left, Right, and Center for a reason. It is such a great show and so necessary these days, unquote. Thank you so much. We agree. Benjamin Hanna also donated. He says LRC is the best. Rich Lowry is my favorite conservative. I'm a progressive. Barrow and the lady from Texas are also amazing. Thank you, Benjamin. We'll pass along thanks from Liz Brunig as well. I also want to thank Teresa Portone, who says she counts on this show for balanced and non-alarmist political commentary. Thank you, Teresa. We try. Please consider becoming a KCRW member at kcrw.com/join. We really appreciate your support. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Christine Emba, what's your Tweet of the Week?
So my tweet is technically actually from last week, but especially relevant after the debates. A lot of people were discussing how sad they were that Marianne Williamson was not there, including me, to be honest. And my acquaintance Drew at GK Bester Friend tweeted, "We love her, but let's be real. Marianne Williamson is Joel Osteen for people with college degrees. Never pretend you're above a grift when that particular grifter isn't pitching you." He was right.
Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
My tweet is from Ari Fleischer, former press secretary for George W. Bush, about the Democratic debate and Biden's answer on his vote for the Iraq War. He says, Biden is rewriting history. The AUMF, which he voted for, was to authorize force in Iraq, and everyone voting at the time knew it. It was not an authorization to go to the UN.
My tweet of the week comes from Sean Trendy. Sean is... My tweets of the week come from Sean Trendy. Sean is senior elections analyst at Real Clear Politics. He also teaches at The Ohio State University. And he tweets on Wednesday, in my intro to American politics class, and he tweeted on Thursday, and he tweeted on September 12th, in my intro to American politics class yesterday, we spent about 10 minutes watching CNN coverage of the 9/11 attacks as they unfolded. Afterwards, I asked students if they felt anxious, and every hand in the class was raised. Many students today were born after the attacks, and almost none remember them. So I explained that most of our modern politics and pathologies are downstream of that and the impeachment of Bill Clinton. The second and third order effects are tremendous. So if you want to understand modern American politics and why the U.S. did many of the things it did in the 2000s, you have to think how you would feel today then, watching it in real time, not knowing how the attacks would unfold. He goes on to describe research about how people who got their news by watching television were more likely to support hawkish policies than people who got their news by reading the newspapers. It is a reminder of how events like this can dramatically reshape the psychology of the electorate and have enormous effects on our politics. I've been talking with Christine Emba of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with Jarrett Blanc to talk about Afghanistan and Iran. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Christine Emba, columnist at The Washington Post. This was a big week for foreign policy news. The president announced last weekend that there was a secret plan for a summit with Taliban leaders at Camp David, but that he was canceling the secret summit because of a Taliban bomb attack in Kabul. 18 years after we invaded Afghanistan, the country remains riven by fighting between a U.S.-backed government and a revived Taliban that controls swaths of the country. And the Trump administration has been trying to reach a deal with the Taliban that would allow the U.S. to withdraw troops. And the president surely saw this potential summit as a great way to look like a peacemaker. But according to news reports, the Taliban was unwilling to come to Camp David without first receiving concessions. To discuss that and also developments related to Iran, we're joined by Jarrett Blanc. He's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And when he was at the State Department, Jarrett worked on the Iran nuclear agreement. Before that, he was the acting special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, focusing on Afghan security, elections, and peace. Hi, Jarrett. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So this was also a big issue at Thursday's Democratic debate. We've been in Afghanistan for so long. Is there a way to withdraw our troops while ensuring that Afghanistan does not become a haven for international terrorist organizations like it was before 9/11?
I think that there is certainly a better policy to pursue in Afghanistan. Any policy in Afghanistan is going to have risks associated. And so I get a little hesitant about the word ensure. But the idea that the United States needs to have 15,000 or 8,000 or frankly 1,000 troops in Afghanistan in order to pursue what are fairly limited counterterrorism objectives, I think just doesn't hold water.
So what do we look for in these negotiations with the Taliban, which had been going on, obviously not at Camp David, for a substantial period before Trump was trying to have this high-profile meeting? What are we looking for? Is there a productive conversation for us to have there that would allow us to do what you describe and reduce that footprint?
So I think there's absolutely a productive conversation. And I think, in fact, a productive conversation was underway with the U.S. Special Envoy Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad until President Trump decided to make a drama out of it last weekend. The conversation sort of breaks into two levels. There are multiple wars being fought in Afghanistan. One of them is approaching 20 years old. It's a war between the United States and the Taliban. The second is 40 years old. It's a civil war between Afghan factions. What Ambassador Khalilzad has managed to do, or had managed to do, was to lay out a framework to resolve the core security issues of the war between the United States and the Taliban. So they get what they want, which is a timeline for U.S. withdrawal. We get what we want, which is a commitment that they will police the territory they control against internationally focused terrorist groups, and also a commitment to start negotiations with the government of Afghanistan and others to try to end that long civil war, which is important to us for a variety of reasons. That's not exactly the sequence that we had worked on in the Obama administration. It's not the ideal sequence, but the concessions that the United States made to get to that sequence are perfectly sensible and are a reasonable way to approach bringing this thing to an end.
Rich, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm very skeptical of this. I understand the exhaustion and frustration with the Afghan war, but I think the problem with any deal with the Taliban, as soon as you get to zero, those commitments they've made, most importantly, to police their territory against international terrorists, completely go out the window. There's no way they're going to comply with that. Why would they? And sort of the clever case for this deal within the administration among hawks who kind of want to tiptoe around Trump more than ousted National Security Advisor John Bolton did was to say, give Trump his deal, and there'll be this annex to the deal that has all these conditions that Taliban has to meet that they won't meet, and that'll allow us to do an off-ramp before we get to zero and end up at 8,600. But the very fact of the deal affects the situation on the ground, and if everyone really thinks we're going to zero, that's a huge benefit to the Taliban. So I think we just go to the minimally effective troop level. A lot of people think it's 8,600. I'm not an expert in this area, and stick there. Because I just don't think there's a good way to police Afghanistan against international terrorists without having some presence there. And there are ancillary benefits of having a presence there, which is that you can, you have an eye into Pakistan and you can raid Pakistan as necessary, which is why we got bin Laden. We wouldn't have gotten bin Laden if we weren't in Afghanistan.
Jared, what do you say to that? How do you enforce the terms of this agreement if we have taken most or all of our footprint out of the country?
Well, I think I would make 2 points. The first is to respond to what Rich has described as kind of the clever case that we'll lay out this troop drawdown timeline, but whether or not we ever complete it will depend on conditions on the ground. And what I would say to that is, of course that's the case. And of course the Taliban and everyone else knows that's the case. The United States has announced repeated withdrawal timelines, and we haven't followed them through. So U.S. leverage, just pure military leverage, before you get into other forms of leverage, remains until the very end. The U.S. gets decision points all along the way. In terms of the broader case of can you eventually imagine going to zero, again, I think the answer there is clearly yes, and you do it in one of two ways. Either you do it because there's been a peace settlement amongst Afghans, which is obviously the most desirable outcome both for us and for the Afghans, which creates kind of a government where power is distributed officially more or less as it is right now unofficially. That kind of balanced government in Afghanistan would be heavily dependent on international financing, and we would have, again, leverage to make sure that they abide by their commitments, including counterterrorism commitments, which we shouldn't exaggerate how difficult and how complicated these would actually be for them. The other alternative is that the deal doesn't take place, in which case the Afghan civil war tragically continues, but it can continue from the U.S.'s perspective with a dramatically lower commitment. So with funds for our partners and probably some offshore military resources that would be needed now and again in counterterrorism circumstances. But the idea that that the U.S. has sufficient security interests in Afghanistan to demand 8,500 or frankly 5,000 or 1,000 troops ad infinitum, not to mention $45 or $50 billion a year, it just isn't borne out.
Christine, what did you make of the discussion about this at the debate on Thursday? Because you heard candidates saying that they want to get troops out of Afghanistan, but lots of people want to get troops out of Afghanistan. The president wanted to, President Obama wanted to. And so this seems like something that a lot of politicians have expressed as a goal or made as a commitment, but it has so far eluded people to find a way to actually get it done.
Yeah, I think that's right. I thought that actually Elizabeth Warren made a really good point in the debate on Thursday night when she said that, you know, we're not going to bomb our way out of terrorism. We're not going to bomb our way out of Afghanistan or any of these conflicts in the Middle East. You know, we've tried that for literally decades at this point, and perhaps we need to try something new. And I think, you know, experts and intelligence experts and military professionals can debate the best way to draw down troops, to do so effectively, to broker peace in some way. But I really think that the majority of Americans are tired. This has been an endless conflict that we didn't necessarily sign up for. And I think that there is a strong appetite for beginning to leave it, hopefully in a way that ensures the safety of our troops on the way out and that ensures or helps to ensure, because that, yes, is not guaranteed, a more stable country. But people are ready to go.
Can we talk a little bit about what happened with Iran this week? I'm frankly confused by what has happened with Iran. So, I mean, first of all, President Trump withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal. He imposed sanctions on Iran. They're describing their policy on Iran as a maximum pressure policy to squeeze Iran financially and bring it to the table. But now we're concerned that Iran is violating the agreement that we have already withdrawn from. The Europeans are even more concerned about this. And now President Trump is flirting with a French proposal to extend a $15 billion credit line to Iran, the purpose of which would be to ease some of the financial difficulties they face under our so-called maximum pressure sanctions. And then if we gave them the credit line, the trade would be that they would have to stay in compliance with the deal that we have withdrawn from. Jarrett, can you explain to me what the possible purpose of this approach could be?
Well, to the extent that I think we understand the discussions that are underway between Paris, Washington, and Tehran, and I don't want to exaggerate how much we do, I think the French proposal is an effort to provide a face-saving way for President Trump to back down without acknowledging that he's backing down. So in addition to pulling out of the JCPOA, of the Iran nuclear deal, President Trump withdrew all of the waivers for Iranian oil sales, the sanctions waivers for Iranian oil sales. He took those waivers all the way down to zero, where previous administrations had left the waivers at sort of a, you know, higher level, kind of some level of income for the Iranian economy. I think the French have concluded, or others have concluded, that Trump is unlikely to reverse that policy and issue oil sales waivers again. But maybe there's a way to get kind of an equivalent amount of revenue to Iran. And this $15 billion line of credit is kind of equivalent to a period of oil revenue for the Iranian national oil company. And so the idea would be they get that back, that revenue. It's a little bit of a return to JCPOA commitments on behalf of the United States, although done in a kind of backwards way. And as you say, in exchange, they resume their compliance with the deal. I think actually what Trump wants more even than their resumption of compliance with the deal is a meeting with President Rouhani, right? I mean, as we saw again with this kind of ludicrous situation with the Taliban and Camp David, he wants to get into the room. And the Iranians have made it, I think, quite clear that the risks and costs associated to sitting down with Donald Trump for them are very, very high. And they're not going to do it unless the Trump administration puts some table stakes down. And this is kind of the French way of, well, let's make some table stakes that don't force Trump to acknowledge that he was wrong on this previous point.
Rich looks sort of dejected as he listens to that description.
It might be right. That's the terrible thing. It might be right. I mean, obviously it just makes no sense. You know, if you wanted the JCPOA, keep it. Stay in it, and you could probably get a meeting with Rouhani anyway, you know, if that's what you want. And we've just seen, I wrote a column about this week, you know, where there was that period when Trump was talking about fire and fury with North Korea. Everybody's a mad bomber, you know, his madman theory is threatening everyone with reckless military action, and he's a mad negotiator. He just loves the idea of sitting down with people, getting in the room, and cutting an audacious deal that proves all the critics wrong and that will dominate the news because it's so unexpected. And I think that's more the common thread of his policy than anything else.
But Christine, this is a pretty remarkable thing for foreign leaders to be figuring out, right? That the way you squeeze the United States is by denying President Trump his photo ops, and then if you give him the photo ops, you might get something of a lot of value.
Yeah, I mean, if Rich looked dejected in New York, I look perhaps even more dejected in D.C. because it's just depressing how much of policy domestically and internationally is just like different expensive ways of helping President Trump save face after making a dumb decision that he didn't need to make anyways and stroking his ego.
Having spent a lot of my life working on these two problems, I can't imagine how dejected I look right now. I think it's worse than Rich said, right? Because it's actually not even that he wants to get into the room and cut an audacious deal. It's actually, he wants to get in the room full stop. And I don't actually think there's enough substance to even get to a deal. And again, the analogy here, I think, is really perfect with the Taliban, where he did all of the damage to the United States just by this tweet that he would have done by actually having the meeting, right? All of the kind of the legitimacy, creating the Taliban on the equal footing of the government of Afghanistan. He did all of that just by saying, hi, I invited them and they wouldn't meet my conditions. And all of that is just because he wants to be in the room, even if he doesn't really have an agenda once he gets there, or an achievable one, certainly.
Right. He's not going to make an audacious deal. He's just going to get into the room, like faff about, cause problems, and then leave it to France to fix. This is not what a president should be doing.
Say what you will about John Bolton, none of this seems like the course of action that John Bolton was likely advising. You know, the meet with, say publicly how you want to meet with Rouhani without preconditions, bring the Taliban to Camp David. So, Rich, it seems like this was an appropriate week for John Bolton to have left the administration, the president saying he fired him, Bolton saying, no, I was trying to quit, and then he fired me before I could get my resignation to him. But, I mean, this is definitely not a John Bolton foreign policy.
No, and he had just butted heads with Trump too many times, and by the end with his Camp David fiasco, which I think vindicated Bolton's warnings about such a course, but that may have irritated Trump more. You know, that there's favorable press about Bolton being right about this, but by the end, just, there was no capital left in the tank, and he's out.
So, Jarrett, you say you alluded to the damage that the president caused to the United States position through this tweet, through disclosing that he was trying and failing to hold this summit. As we've watched what's gone on with North Korea, I have wondered from time to time the extent to which what the president does really damages our position, because it has seemed to me like, you know, the previous three presidents weren't able to fix the North Korea situation. It has been static and has basically remained static. At least the president isn't launching nuclear weapons at anything. How can we apply that analysis to the Afghanistan and Iran situations? Because it seems like the Iran situation is actually pretty fluid. The Afghanistan situation, I don't know how to evaluate that. You know, what the opportunity cost is here, given that the Obama administration, the Bush administration were also not able to resolve what the problems are that we have in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, look, every case is different. In the North Korea situation, I think the damage done is that at one time there was a tremendously valuable offer to be made to North Korea to have a first summit with the president of the United States. And we could have gotten something big for that. Instead, we got nothing for that. So that's something that we've paid. In the Iran situation, and this is why I'm absolutely not going to be involved in the, you know, the post hoc hagiography of John Bolton, this mess is largely his fault. There was no off-ramp for there is no off-ramp for the maximum pressure strategy. The things that the Trump administration claims to want out of Iran are not going to be achieved as a result of sanctions pressure. And so it's true that Bolton probably would see through the sort of the French ruse here, but he doesn't have a better solution to propose. And so where that leaves us with Iran, what Trump's drama has cost us is that we had a decent working deal that had Iran's nuclear ambitions in a box, and that left us free to deal with other problems that Iran causes for U.S. policy. And now we're back in a situation where everything has to again be about the nuclear program, because that is correctly our top priority, and it's no longer solved. In the Afghanistan case, I mean, this is very, very clear. Ambassador Khalilzad had a deal, and it was a way to start the drawdown of U.S. forces and to get the Taliban in the room with the government of Afghanistan. Because that deal didn't involve a starring role for Donald Trump, it now isn't taking place. And that is a huge cost to all of us. It's a huge cost to all of those American soldiers who are still going to be risking their lives in Afghanistan for very little national security gain. And finally, it's likely to get only more costly, because I think there's every chance that Donald Trump is going to go ahead and announce the beginning of the drawdown of U.S. forces. And so he's going to get, instead of getting something for that announcement, the deal that Ambassador Khalilzad had negotiated, he's going to get nothing. So you know, there is a common theme here, but when you dig into every case, it just gets uglier and uglier.
Well, on that note, Jarrett Blanc is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Jarrett, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
It's beginning to become an article of faith among some people on the left that people themselves are a problem because they contribute too much to carbon emissions. This is a profoundly mistaken and deeply unhumane view of looking at the world and at people. Build windmills if you must, but don't try to scare people out of having children, or much worse, facilitate abortions in your zeal to save some fraction of a degree off the global temperature 80 years from now.
Christine Embo, what's your rant?
My rant would be against ambition. Not ambition in a basic sense, which is just, you know, a sort of strong desire to achieve something through hard work, but overweening ambition, the sort that takes over your life and makes you do things that you shouldn't be doing. And this comes to mind because I feel like we saw a lot of that second type of ambition actually during the Thursday debate. You saw it with Joe Biden, who, frankly, is old and has gone through a lot in his life and should be, you know, resting with his family and recovering from that. And yet he's still duking it out on this debate stage. It's not entirely clear that he even wants to be there because he's driven by something. And I think it's this overweening ambition. You saw it with Castro pulling these like mean and rather vicious punches. You saw it with Andrew Yang, who, why is he on that stage? Doesn't he have anything else to do other than, you know, give out these gimmicky ideas? This overweening ambition pushes people to become almost the worst or saddest versions of what they are. And I think America could deal with a step back.
For my rant, speaking of overweening ambition, Tom Steyer has qualified for the next Democratic debates in October, which means that even though we had a one-stage 10-candidate debate this month, next month, in theory, we're going to have at least 11 candidates, and maybe it'll be split over two nights, which is super annoying. But I have a solution to propose to this. They should just not let Tom Steyer debate. I realize that's not in line with the DNC rules, but really, who would complain other than Tom Steyer? It feels like we could get away with just breaking the rules. Alternatively, if he has to be allowed in the debate, what they should do is they should just put all 11 candidates on one stage and just not ask Tom Steyer any questions. And if Tom Steyer tries to talk, the debate moderator should just shush him until he stops talking. It seems to me that technically complies with the DNC rules. It is so annoying. Why is he running for president? What is he doing there? It's just like, you know, he became a billionaire and therefore he's smart enough to that he has to run in what is, I think, frankly, a fairly strong field. He's not needed. He should go away. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Christine Emba, Dorian Warren, and Jarrett Blanc. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington is our production assistant. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.